Welcome to a Responsible Day for the 20th of Elul. My name is Gideon Rothstein, and I offer these shirim with the hosting of, and I am grateful for the hosting of Rabbi Jacob Abramowitz, David Hochhauser, and OU for helping us give these shirim, make these shirim available to you. Today we're going to see Shu'at Divrei Yatziv, Kosh and Mishpat, Siman Yin Aleph, the Klosenberger Rebbe, in his volume of response, the Kosh and Mishpat section, response number 11. This is from the 20th of Elul of Tuf Shin Lamed of 1970, and he's responding to a letter talking about this is a relatively theoretical concept, and yet it brings up some issues that are interesting to think about in terms of how we would apply them in real halacha. The Gemara in Sanhedrin and Daf Pi Aleph Amud Aleph says that if somebody transgresses the Torah, it will have actually some ramifications for us. I actually just quoted a pasuk that the Klosenberger brings up and points out to us recently in a recent conversation. The Gemara says if somebody violated the Torah in front of a Beit Din in a way that would require the death penalty. So let's say a man, God forbid, but kills another man in front of a Beit Din, in front of a court. So there may or may not have been witnesses there, but the real fundamental point the Gemara is making, their concern of the Gemara is that in this situation, it was what's called an Eidut She'iyata Yechol LaHazima. And so I'll explain that concept in a second, but this man was a treifa. The murderer was a treifa. Treifa in the Gemara and Hanalacha's understanding is a person who has a physical wound that will kill them within a year. The definitions of treifot in kashrus, for example, is a complicated issue. And in terms of people, it's a complicated issue today because those kinds of wounds are not as common today in the definitions of them. And I think we've seen that in other occasions, what we call a life-threatening wound or a life-killing wound. But let's say, for example, that we know the person has, sadly, a cancer that will kill them, you know, before a year, so they're a treifa. That's called an depends on another concept called Hazama. Hazama means that when the Torah set up the concept of testimony, of witnesses in courts taking testimony, sometimes we know witnesses can lie. It's sad to think that's true, but unfortunately that's true. How do you catch a witness in a lie? So theoretically you could say, well, if somebody else comes along and says you're lying, but that's a difficult situation because if two witnesses say Joe killed Jack, and two other witnesses say, Joe did not kill Jack. I was standing right there. How do we believe? So now it's called Edei HaKhasha. Two sets of witnesses or two witnesses contradict each other. There in Halacha, we think of that as a stalemate. The fact that one came first and one came second doesn't matter to us. If we can find a way to ask them questions and it becomes clear that one set of witnesses isn't really valid, so that's the way to handle it. But if they're just equally valid as far as we can tell, if we have no reason to think, if we have nothing, no evidence that one is more truthful than the other, that's called, those are called that's an edut mukheshet. It is a contradicted testimony, and then there's all sorts of halachos of how we deal with it. Basically, we're not allowed to trust it. And we sort of have to suspect that each of them are lying, and that has halachic ramifications. But the Torah set up another concept, a very difficult concept, and it's talked about a lot, and it's a big kiddush, it's a novel idea called hazama, which is, if the second group of witnesses don't say, you're lying, that didn't happen because we saw that it didn't happen. If they say instead, you couldn't possibly know that because you were with us somewhere else at the time you were saying you witnessed this, that's, we believe those second witnesses. It's a complicated concept. We're not going to be able to talk about it here. It's a concept, but that's the way the halakha goes. And it has ramifications that would seem illogical or seem difficult to believe, and yet that's the way it goes. By virtue of saying, rather than saying you're lying because it didn't happen that way, they say you can't know that. Not you're lying. It could have happened. I don't know. Meaning, maybe you heard from somebody you trust, and therefore you're saying maybe it actually did happen that way. I don't know that. All I know is you can't know that, and therefore I know you can't be a witness. That's called hazama, and we believe the second set of witnesses, the edim hamezimim, the witnesses who say you couldn't know that. Now, by the way, if another set of witnesses come along and say, you can know that that person was in that place that you're saying he was with you, or those witnesses were with you in that place because you weren't in that place, you were with us in some other place, we'll believe those last witnesses. And then the first witnesses will be believed again because there's no hazama against them because that hazama has been proved invalid. Complicated set of concepts, a whole discussion that you can learn much of Masechet Makot or a chunk of Masechet Makot talks about it. But here's the key point for us. The halacha also is that before we accept testimony in court, it has to be an edut she'ata yechol lahazima. When somebody gives testimony in court about somebody else or about another issue, and we're going to try to accept that testimony as valid for our court purposes, we're not allowed to accept that testimony, and unless and until the witnesses are susceptible to hazama, unless and until the witnesses could be muzam. If there's no threat of that in their lives, then we can't accept their testimony. An example where that is in the case of giving testimony against a treif. And the reason for that is because the punishment for being muzam, if somebody is proven to be an aid zomim, that's the term for it, if somebody's proven to be an aid zomim, what the Torah requires, they get the punishment, if it's kasher zamam, lasot l'achiv, as that person attempted to do, as he maliciously attempted to do to his fellow Jew, so it should be done to him. In the case of a treifa, there's nothing to do about it, because in the case of a treifa, what the witnesses were trying to do, where they were trying to have him put to death for the crime that he committed. But even if we put the treifa to death for the crime, if they turn out to be aid zomimim, if it turned out that we find out that the other witness comes that you couldn't have known that, then you'd say, well, put them to death. Now, in the case of a person, of a defendant, we think of as ordinarily healthy, that makes sense. The witnesses try to bring about the death of the ordinarily healthy defendant. They are turned out to be aid zomimim, they're put to death. That's a simple halakhic case. Where the defendant is a treifa, however, the defendant's life is known to be limited by in a very specific way. So therefore, putting the witnesses to death would not be commensurate, would not be exactly what they tried to do to the defendant, because the defendant was in a more precarious health state. And therefore, that's considered an edut shi'ata yachol lahazima. You can't give testimony against the treifa because there's no hazama possible. The witnesses could not be put to death, could not be punished in that way for their testimony. Now, what Tosafot pointed out was that if somebody violated, if a treifa, this man, this defendant who's going to die with it soon, and therefore you couldn't ever put him to death in court because you could never have a testimony against him because it would be an eidut shi'ata yachol lahazima, committed that crime in front of the Beit Din, then the court would put him to death, Tosos claim, because of Uvi'arta hara mikirbecha. Uvi'arta hara mikirbecha is a puzzle that comes up several times in the Torah, where the Torah says, we have a requirement as a communities, and this is not just when you do or don't have a court, it's a requirement in communities to try to make sure that we get rid of all the evil, whatever that evil may be, from our midst. So Tosos says that's an obligation to Tosos. So the man writing the letter to the Klausenberger Rebbe said, I don't understand why Tosos had to reach for Uvi'arta hara mikirbecha. We have a concept when it comes to courts that they can judge things because of lo tehei, by their sight. When they see things that are wrong in front of them, that just the fact that they saw it is enough for them to decide. When they don't need testimony at all, meaning this man is saying, why did Joseph have to reach for a viata rami kirbecha? It's just an exception that when an event occurs in front of a Beit Din, the Beit Din has the right to judge on the basis to enact verdicts on the basis of what they saw, just because it happened in front of them. That's a whole different halakha. That's what he's seeing. It's a whole different maslul, a whole different path, a whole different track of how he did it. So the whole question of eidut shatei yachol lazima or not yachol lazima, testimony that you can or cannot have hazama for, it doesn't seem to be relevant here, is the question. So the Klausenberger Rebbe, Rav Halberstam, points out, he says, it's not quite that way. When it comes to a Beit Din acting upon what they saw, that's because of a principle in the Gemara of lo tehei shmi'ah gidola miri'iyah, that the fact that they hear testimony from witnesses shouldn't be considered more believable, right? More credible than seeing it themselves, meaning the point of testimony is trying to establish a fact pattern that occurred. Witnesses come and say, so-and-so borrowed money from so-and-so. And the court investigates the witnesses and they say, oh, interesting. But if the court itself saw it as a court, they were sitting in judgment as a court and a man came in and gave a loan to somebody else for the loan, you wouldn't need testimony. That's the way the principle of Lotei Shmi'ah Gedola Miri'iyah goes. And Tosafot and Ketubot, and not all Tosafot have to agree with each other, so theoretically you can say, well, different Tosafot do different things, but Tosafot and Ketubot do say that that phrase, the way the Gemara phrases the fact that a Beit Din is allowed to trust its own, what it sees itself, Lotei Shmi'ah Gedola Miri'iyah, suggests that it's actually a kind of inherent Kabbalat Edut. Meaning, when I say the court is allowed to act upon what it itself sees, what do I mean by that? So there are lots of options, but Rabbi Halberstam, the Divrei Yatziv, the Klausenberger Rebbe, is pointing out that Tosafot say that the phrasing of it, he could have just said, why can't a court act? They saw it. But when it says it as a comparison question, lo tehei shmi'ah gidola meri'iyah, hearing should not be any worse. I mean, could not be better than seeing it themselves. That sounds like the seeing it themselves is replacing the hearing from witnesses. If so, then it means that the seeing it themselves is like a kind of testimony, a kind of witnessing. It's not a witnessing where they then have to relate the testimony, they have to speak out, they have to say, I hate that phrase, I apologize for it. They have to say what they saw, but it is a testimony of seeing and of having experienced it, and that's witnessing. That's what. So if that were true, the point of that, the importance of that Tosfos is, if that were true, then it would mean that what the court does when it sees something and acts upon it is a kind of witnessing. If we generally require for witnessing a ducha tayachol lahazima, a witnessing that could be susceptible to testimony, so then you need it, right? To hazaba, to be coming in his own mim, so then the treifa case shouldn't be one that the Gemara has, that the Beit Din, that the court has the right to act upon, because it's true they saw it themselves. It's true we know it happened. But the point of requiring an edushi she'atayachol lahazima is not only that we have to be sure that it's true, it's that that's a technical requirement the Torah inserted into the process of edut, the process of testimony. If that's true and you need it, and they're functioning as kinds of witnesses, or they're super witnesses, right? Because they're witnesses who, in the whole event of witnessing and relating the testimony and having the judges know that this testimony is accurate, all happen within the judges' heads, but it's still a form of testimony. And if that's true, judges' heads and eyes, if that's true, then you would have a problem of needing the possibility of hazama before you could accept this and act upon this event that they saw. Tosfos Mavakama says the same thing, says a very similar thing. They're witnessing it, they're seeing it, is like an automatic acceptance of testimony, and therefore all those rules theoretically would apply. And above Basra as well, meaning that you have Tosfos all over the place that seem to say that what happens when a court sees something itself is that it's not a breaking of the verse, Al Pishnei Medimi Matamed. It's not a breaking of the idea that we need eyewitness testimony before we punish people in halacha. It's that the seeing of the judges, even though they're judges rather than witnesses, but since they're the ones who would eventually have accepted the testimony, it sort of collapses altogether the stages. The witnessing, bearing testimony, and the judges hearing it all get collapsed into that one act of the judges seeing it themselves, and therefore it's not really a completely separate halacha of Beit Din. It's an example of a way in which witnessing can occur that the judges can have. If so, you'd need the hazama issue to be relevant, and the fact that the defendant is a treifa would be a problem in terms of whether or not, but it would be a problem in terms of being able to punish him, because it should still be an edut sheita chol hazima. That would explain why Tosfot reached for a different concept. It would be art darami kirbecha. Art darami kirbecha for that Tosfot would be the idea that when a court knows that there's evil among the Jewish people, one of the court's other responsibilities, one responsibility of the court is to sit in judgment when there are plaintiffs and defendants to hear the two sides, or when there's somebody who's accused of a crime to judge whether that person actually did the crime based on testimony in the ordinary process. Another responsibility of the court is to be functioning in the name of producing more wholesome Jewish societies in which Ra, and then you'd have to find what Ra is, but in which Ra is extirpated, in which evil is gotten rid of. And that's the one that Tosfos was invoking. They were saying, okay, maybe it's true that you can't ever put a treifa, you can never punish a treifa for his actions, violating Shabbos, stealing, whatever they may be, violating Yom Tov, right? It doesn't have to be death penalty, actually. You can't violate a treifa for his actions because testimony against that treifa will always be a duchi yetei yacholis. It will always be testimony that you could not have people where it would be always be a question of witnesses against that person could never be edim zomim, and therefore you couldn't hear those witnesses. But there's another path, b'yatar amik yirbech. That's what Tosfos seems to be reasoning. That's what the Rosenberger is defending. He's saying, yeah, that's based on Tosfos' general assumption that when we have courts that witness something themselves and act upon it, that's a form of hearing testimony and giving testimony and acting upon testimony, and that's not allowed in the case of a treifa. And therefore, you have to reach for that other idea, b'yatar amik yirbech. Now the Rosenberger says another halakhic ramification he thinks might be, if you're going to say that it's a form of testimony, let's suppose a court, and leave aside the Hazama thing. Now let's say the defendant is somebody who is, as far as we know, an ordinarily healthy person, and therefore witnesses could have come and could bear testimony. Let's say that person walks into a sitting court, 23, let's say, and commits a terrible crime, a Shabbos crime, whatever it is. They do something that would be punishable by death, by lashes, whatever they're punishable by. But one of the sitting judges is a karov, is a relative, or is for some other reason puzzle, for some other reason not valid to judge or to give testimony in this case. So the Urim V'Tumim and the Ktzot had, and the Pitkei Tshuva had said that if you're going to hold, as it seems to be true, that seeing it on the part of the Beit Din is another form of testimony, another way that testimony can occur without the formal, without all of the steps of testimony. But it's really an actual, a kind of testimony, a kind of bearing witness. If you're going to hold that way, then if one of the judges is not a valid witness, and he was in the group, so that's a whole other halakhic question of its own, how you define the group and not. That's why sometimes at weddings, for example, you'll hear the person who's organizing the wedding will say, the Masechta Kiddushin will say, these two, whoever they may be, are the only witnesses to this event. The reason is because you're worried. It's almost always true that at a wedding you have people in the audience who are relatives, and relatives are not valid to be witnesses on an event, and therefore you're worried that if you don't define the group very carefully, they'll be included in the group, it'll ruin the whole thing. So that's the whole question. So let's say you have a judge sitting there, and the judge is invalid for some reason for this case. A relative is the easy example of it. So all these achronim hold, then according to Tosos, then they even if they witness it themselves, they can't, because you have in their groups, it's a form of testimony, in their group they have an invalid witness, and the invalid witness is not only invalid himself, but invalidates whatever group he is a part of. The Nesivos, the closing book points out, the Nesivos HaMishpat on that discussion disagreed. And he said, just like we're going to allow a court like that to put to death a treifa if necessary, treifa, which is an etuchiyeh toyachol azima, where you couldn't have had a zama. So he said, so in those kinds of situations, like, not in a regular case. In a regular case, it could be the Tosfos holds it just like re'iyah, it's just like testimony in a different form. But if you're going to say that it's because of a reason, if it's going to be in a situation of lo teishmiyag dolar mi re'iyah, if you're going to say that we're going to allow it even for where it should theoretically not work with regular testimony, and he gives the example of a treifa, then you should also be able to use invalid witness as well. Meaning the Nesivo seems to understand the principle of lo tehesh miyagdola meriyah, that hearing it from witnesses can't be better than seeing it themselves, to mean that seeing it themselves is actually better than that, is actually a whole different alternative form of how the events will work, of getting to a verdict. It's sort of extra testimonial, right? It has nothing to do with testimony. It's just a way of saying it. And therefore, he seems to accept invalid, who people would ordinarily be invalid witnesses, because we have a whole group seeing it, and that's a whole different path, a whole different track. And then Rabbi Yehuda, he points out, has a tshuva in which he says that there's no idea of the whole idea of Hazam. Rabbi Yehuda says, it's a little difficult to me in terms of these social. Rabbi Yehuda says that Dayanim, that when it comes to judges and they're going to be enacting a verdict on the basis of what they saw, there's no idea of Hazam at all because they're not witnesses at all. And even if they were, even when we act upon what they saw because of the principle of Lotesh Magdalaria, he says straight out, look at the Tosos, you see, you put people to death, even, and you don't require Hazam. So he, the Rabbi Yehuda, along with the Sivos, seems to have understood that even the Tosos invokes the words of Yata Rami Kirbecha, what he really means is that Lotesh Magdalaria, that Tosos means Lotesh Magdalaria, that witnessing, that seeing themselves shouldn't be any worse than hearing it from witnesses, actually means there's an alternative way that they can function, an alternative way they can come to verdicts, and that alternative way doesn't partake of any of the rules of testimony as long as the judges know on the basis of their own sight that it happened. Then Rav Halberstam says, but to me, I think it seems that the other Achron are right, and I think it's got to be that together. Edut, as I've said, for all these reasons. So he points out to Machlok and Achronim, but he's taking a side in them, Machlok and Achronim, that debate between the Achronim, and he thinks that Tosus means that when judges see it themselves, that's a kind of testimony, and therefore it ordinarily partakes of the rules of testimony, and where we see that they're allowed to do something that witnesses could not have produced, that's going to be for a different reason. That's why Tosfos reaches for Ubiar Tahara Mikir Becha. And then he points out that his ancestor, who was the first, the Sanzer Rebbe, the Divrei Chaim, he's the Divrei Yatziv, the Divrei Chaim, had said something very similar, as had Menchus Chinuch. In other words, he's finding many, many Akronim who he thinks have understood Tosfos this way, and that's why he thinks that's the right way to understand Tosfos. That's what's going on here. And yet, for all this discussion about where it comes up, it doesn't end up having that much of a practical difference in terms of Eidut Shiyatei Yechol Lazima, because while it's true that in terms of Eidut, we couldn't have the judges function, and therefore, to the extent that we say that they're seeing it as a form of Eidut, we would say, but you need Eidut Shiyatei Yechol Lazima, but you have another obligation of Ubiar Tahara Mikir Becha, and that as soon as they know that there's Ra in their midst, they're required to act on it without all the formal court procedures. That's an important point as well. Meaning, let's suppose a court knows that's something going on in a community. So they would have the responsibility to act upon that thing that's going on in the community, even without, they couldn't apply any of the formal court strictures. So let's say they knew there's a lot of Chil Shabbos in the community. Sadly, there's a community, a lot of people are not keeping Shabbos where they're supposed to be keeping Shabbos. So they're supposed to act upon that even if they can't act on it in a formal court way because they haven't seen it, they don't know that, but they have to act on it. So that's the Rabbi Kirbecha, is that there's a responsibility that where you know there's ra, where you know there's things going wrong, you're supposed to act upon them to remove them. Now, what you can and can't do might depend on how well you know it and how fully you know it and things like that, but that's what's going to happen here. They saw the treifa kill somebody. They know the treifa, this man, is a ra, is somebody who's done evil, and therefore they have a responsibility to act upon it, even though they can't do it as a formal court and testimony issue. The next is just that there's a Rambam that points it this way, because in the Rambam passed in this halacha, the Gemara, in the second chapter of Hilchos Rotzeach, of the laws of murderers, halacha 9, paragraph 9, the way he phrased it is that an adam treifa, a man who has a wound or something that's going to kill him within a year, as far as we understand it, who committed murder, is killed. This is what he writes it, is killed, is neherag, and the source for that, he says, is, you have to get rid of all the evil in your midst. And then he says, later on in the halakha, as long as he kills in front of a court. So the Rav Halberstam says, really, it should have theoretically been the way. He should have said, if they bait in, if he did it before bait in, he'll be killed. As it says, meaning, if you think of the treifa who killed as being very similar to ordinary cases of murder, then you should have said, and the only reason it has to be in front of a court is because in front of a court, you'll be able to enact it. You should have said, a treifa sharag, b'fnei beit din ne'arag, because the b'fnei beit din is just a condition of where he committed the murder in order for us to be able to, for the technical reason, for us to be able to put him to death. But the way he says it here, the Halberstam points out, makes it sound like here the obligation in terms is in, the whole obligation is in terms of v'yarta ra, and that would be because it's always an edut she'ateh ochol izimah, so there's no way to kill him as a function of the statute against murder, of the lo tirtach, of the you can't kill another Jew statute. To enact that statute, we would have needed testimony, and the treifa can never have actually valid court testimony against him, and therefore the Rambam says, yeah, you're right, in the case of a treifa, this is the way the Halberstam is reading it, in the case of a treifa, the punishment and the issue is never going to be in terms of murder, because that's always going to be a testimony. Even when a court sees it, that's still a kind of testimony. So the issue is, and that's where the Rambam puts it that way. There's a bit more to the tshuva about whether or not we can give a higher form, a lower form of capital punishment if we can't give the higher form, and how that would be affected by the discussion of Biatara, but it's A, not so clear to me, the back and forth. It's sort of a little bit of a back and forth that doesn't end up in adding to my reading very much the conversation. And I do have a brief tshuva, a brief response of Rechaim David Halevi's about another issue that I think might be interesting to us that I'd like to share with you. So in Shuta Stei Lechai Rav, Chelik Dalet Siman in Bed, Volume 4, response number 52, Rechaim David Halevi was asked about opening another school with the new school. It's not necessarily opening it, but it's also patronizing a new school, where the new school, patronizing the new school, which might have a higher level of Jewish observance and Torah learning, but it will cause problems for the existing school. So the existing school might be at a lower level of observance and of learning and this, and therefore you can have parents say, well, no, I want my kid to get the best education possible, but that's going to hurt the original school. Are they allowed to go for the old school? So then are they allowed to go to the new school and patronize the new school and build a new school? That's a stick with the old school. The problem that sadly comes up many, many times in the Jewish community. So he says, I got your letter of the 20th, they're a little tough shin la mitet. Ordinarily, for those of you who have been with me, we know that Rabbi Chaim David Halevi doesn't always give the year, often doesn't give the year, but I found a few where he gives the year. So this is from the 20th of Elul, 1979. He says, I got the letter on Erev Rosh Hashanah, and because it's such an important issue, and it's coming up because the school year is just starting, I'm gonna respond to you as soon as I can. But since we're between Rosh Yom Kippur, it's been Kesel La'asor, so now we know sometime we have a better idea when he wrote this exactly himself, which we don't usually have in his letter, because he usually just says, I got your letter of such and such date, and that's how we use it. But in any case, I'm writing quickly because it's a busy time, and I hope you'll forgive me. So this is the question. The question is, about a year ago, they established a local school in whatever, settlement, village, small town they are in, a school, and the point was it to create a better Torah education for their children, and because it was hard to travel to wherever the other school was, and there were security issues, right? In 79, certainly the state of Israel wasn't in the most secure place, wherever they're living, there's security issues in travel, but when they made the decision, they explicitly agreed, and this is going to be important to the children, they explicitly agreed, the parents could send their kids to where they want to, they didn't have to send their kids to this Beit Sefer, to this school, and last year, it wasn't a problem. Last year, they had the school, and it operated, and all was fine. But this year, it turns out, some minority of the parents have decided that they want to take their kids out of the school and they want to send them to another place, to another school. And they think it'll be better for their kids because the school is small, it seems like. They think it's narrow. The social circle is narrow and there it's broader and therefore the education is broader. For all I know, they have more offerings there. These are just things that come up all the time in education and parents and communities. Now, that's going to happen. What's going to happen then is that what was already apparently somewhat of a small school is going to be so small that the school either have to close or it's going to have a hard time operating. And the settlement, the town had hoped that having a school in it would help it grow as a community, would help it grow as a settlement, and it would help develop a greater sense of Limud Torah, Torah study, and Yirat Shamayim, and fear of heaven. So are these parents allowed to do that when they're damaging the community in this way? Can they take their kids out? Because they've got these educational issues. It's a classic question in terms of communities and individual rights, and where can my concerns for my child's best education allow me to separate from the community and not partake in all these kinds of issues. So Chaim Dovalevi points out in Bava Batra, Chaf Aleph, Amid Aleph, Rava says there was a Takan of Yehoshua ben Gamla. The Takan of Yehoshua ben Gamla was a Kohen Gadol in the Second Temple period, and is generally thought of as being a very, very good person. He's an interesting figure of his own. But from that time on, the rule was you don't take children from one place to another, but you do take them from one shul, one synagogue, one Beit Knishta to another within the same town. What that means, so we'll talk about it. Rashi held that it means you don't take him from one place to another because you're worried that the travel might hurt the kid. Because it's a dangerous thing and you don't want to put kids in danger, right? It would be like saying, if you have a school walking distance and you have a school that you have to take a bus, you know, on a 40-mile journey every day, that the odds of traffic accidents are so much greater that we don't allow that to happen, and therefore parents are required to keep their kids close. So be like that. I'm not saying we say that. We're going to get to that here, but that's what the way Rashi understood it. Take a kid intercity. If you take a kid from one city to another city to go to school, and every day they're traveling that far, well, that was part of the takara. We don't do that. We only do it within a city. Within a city, you can take them from one place to another because it's not as dangerous. And the question, according to Rashi, was, can the parents who need teaching force the community to pay for a teacher? Now, in their times, schools were much less formal. You needed a malamed tinuk, you needed a guy, and that guy would teach all the local kids who would be 10, 15. Once it got to be over, I think, 25, you got a new one, but you got another one. And they forced them to pay that fee for that to happen so they don't have to ship their kids. Meaning there's a Malami Tinoka is 5 miles away. Other people in the community say, just pay for a car service, right? Pay for a wagon. Pay for this. So the answer, Rashi's saying that part of the Takana of Yehoshua ben Gamla was, we don't do that. And Rashi thought it was because of the danger to the kids of traveling all the time, of commuting. Tosfos and Rashi seem to agree with Rashi. But if that's true, then it doesn't really tell us anything about our situation, he says, because today, the question of establishing a school and paying for it was handled, a lot of it, by the Department of Education. How many kids are in a class? That was the Department of Education. Mostly Mishrad HaKinuk, the Department of Education paid for schools, so parents didn't pay for public education. So once this school in the local town had been approved, they'd get their subsidy from the government to run to some extent, whatever extent they would, and therefore that wasn't a monetary issue. So for Rashi, it seems like that, since that was the question in hand for Rashi, when could parents insist that other parents pay, that other people in the community pay to support a malamed, it doesn't seem to be the issue. But the Rambam reads the sugya in a different, for Rashi tells us in Rashi, but Rambam reads the sugya in a different question, in a different way. Rambam says that no, the whole sugya is about when do you take the child to a new teacher who's a better teacher, who will teach the kid quicker or more effectively. So within a city you do it, but between cities you don't do it. So the Rav Chaim Dovalevi says the Rambam seems to be addressing exactly our topic. In the Rambam's opinion, commuting to a new city is not allowed. You know, that's in your kitty, but your child to a new city, another city, for the purpose of learning, except that the Rambam would seem to assume that that's because of issues of betichut, issues of security, of safety, even if the other teacher is in a very close by city. So if that would be true, you'd say the parents in your community who have a school, local school, shouldn't be allowed to send their child to another one because of betichut, except that that doesn't really seem to be the issue here, because the man who's complaining is complaining talking about its effect on the local school, not upon the security question. So, meaning, if today people tend to travel, let's say, a half hour by bus to a new city and nobody thinks twice of it, and yes, sadly, occasionally there may be tragedies that occur, but those have nothing to do with the safety of the activity, right? There are people who just drive their car five blocks with their children in it, and sadly something happens. Nobody says that's a problem. There are people who have accidents when they're walking. So since it doesn't seem to be that, that's not the issue that he's raising the issue of, it's going to hurt the school. So kind of Levy says there's no responsibility on parents to sacrifice their children's education for the sake of keeping a local school going. He says, I don't know of halacha that if you have, let's say within a city, the halacha that we were just quoting, you're within a city, we say you're allowed to every degree. Within a city, within a town, you can move from one shul to the other, to another malamed, who's a better malamed. So nobody says, oh, but you have to worry about the first malamed. He's not going to be able to support himself. So you don't have to worry about these things because parents are allowed to be concerned with the best quality of education for their children. He does, so then he says, so it seems like the security is not an issue. If security is not an issue, then he thinks you don't have a problem. So you have to think about whether security is an issue. He thinks it's likely that it's not because of just the way the world is working. And so he fundamentally thinks the parents have the right to do that. Then he throws in a bracha at the end to say, but I see that you're trying hard to build up the local standards of Torah, and I wish you much success, and I hope it works out for you, even though basically I'm not going to give you the support of saying that the good parents, right, with the good kids, have to stay in belt. So that, I think, raises important, interesting questions. Quite a lot of you see fundamentally the halacha is the parents are allowed to focus on their own kids' education, so they don't have to sacrifice the quality of their kids' education for the sake of supporting something. They have to support it financially, but that's an issue in Israel at the time because of the Mishrad HaKinuch, the part of education. But that in terms of putting their kids there, they're not required to do so as long as the choice they're making is not one that puts their kids in halakhically defined danger, then they have the right to be sure to do their best to give their kids their best education. That is a responsibility of the 20th of Elul. Most of the time on the Klosenberger Rebbe, on courts witnessing something and on extirpating evil from our midst, and a bit on Rav Chaim David HaLevi about building up local schools and how we do and don't do so. Have a great day.